Welcome to the Leaders Playlist. Our guest today is Stuart Elliott. Stuart is a leader who has a passion for culture, diversity, and inclusion. And his expertise in these areas make him the perfect guest for us today to talk about our topic of courage. Welcome, Stu. Can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself, please?
So I actually did economics at university. I started work in business banking. I started working with medium-sized organisations. And I found myself probably about 6 months in doing the, 1500th version of a spreadsheet of profit and loss and balance sheet, and foresaw a life where I was just basically manipulating numbers and the understanding that numbers are always going to be the same. You know, what I was seeing, it was just a future ahead of me where the problem solving was always the same problem. It was just a problem of do the numbers actually make sense? At the same time, I'd been interested in getting into, you know, HR or something to do with people, and I had an opportunity to go and support one of the state managers, and this was in a bank, and to do some of his HR stuff for him. And I took it, and I really sort of never went back. It was only a 3-month gig, and I sort of went from there into heading up the New South Wales recruitment function for one of the major banks. I worked in strategy. I've worked in, you know, at a general manager in an operations environment for one of the banks, looking at, you know, things like offshoring and partnering and automation. So what has happened is that I've created a career out of problem solving for people, and which actually really, really nicely then moved me into workforce strategy. What is the future of the world of work? What's it going to lead to? How do we grapple with the problems of the impacts that's going to have on people? What are the skills and capabilities that people are going to need that are going to be valued and are going to be sought after by organisations? And how do we, in the face of that, actually accept, rather than fight against that, but how do we accept that that's the future and lean into it, rather than what I see in organisations, which is an enormous amount of resistance, and then organisations that get it just bypassing them and their speed of change. So that for me is the heart of what I do. But it all comes from that understanding that when you're dealing with people, no two problems are the same, because no two people are the same. And I think that's created for me a great career in dealing with people and dealing with problems and trying to, you know, navigate a path through those things to help businesses succeed.
So our topic of conversation today is around courage. So leading on from what you just said, what does courage mean to you? What does it look like?
I think courage, and we can talk about, you know, what the opposite is, because it's also an important thing, but courage is, you know, really simply constructive action in the face of risk. It is not the, you know, ignorance of risk. It is not the absence of risk. It is a choice to act in a particular way in the face of that risk, which means that in many ways, the opposite is either a choice to act in another way or a choice to not act, which is probably the most common form of non-courageous behavior. It's choosing not to act. It's actually, but that's a choice in and of itself. You know, inaction is a choice as much as action is a choice. Courage is the choice to act and to act in a way that is constructive in the face of that risk. Quite often with a sense of fear as well, but it is a determination that action in that situation is actually more going to be more effective for me and for the environment than inaction or destructive action.
That's an interesting take on it. I've never thought about it that way. And then I have to take a point is it's not courage if you don't feel fear, right? There's no
Correct.
Sort of fear.
Correct. It's not. No, that's absolutely 100%. Fear is there, but what distinguishes people who are courageous is at some point they make a decision in that fear to do something that's constructive, to do something that is, you know, having a positive impact on either themselves or those around them. And I think it can be, you know, it can be one or the other, but it is absolutely, Dave, it's absolutely not the absence of fear, because it doesn't require courage if you don't feel fear.
So in your kind of talk, the way you talked about it, in taking a decision to be some certain way, behaving a certain way. So, for example, being your true self or being authentic to yourself.
Absolutely.
And everything is showing up.
Absolutely. What I mean, and if you think about that, and let's unpick that for a bit. When you go into an organisation, most people's fear stems from their how they'll be seen by others. So, you know, self-image, the perspective that They won't be impactful in the thing. And so we all put on a mask in organisations to make sure that we are doing that which we think will get the most impact on others and make us more effective in the eyes of others. Courageous people go, actually, I think I'll be more effective if I'm true to myself, if I'm authentic, because what will happen is then I will, if I succeed, then I will have succeeded as my true self. And if I don't succeed, then obviously this organization is not going to create the right environment or the right culture for me to be successful. But that's a risk. You know, that's a risk for people to be authentic, for people to say this is who I am, is a profound risk. I mean, it's a risk in relationships. It's a risk in marriage. It's a risk, you know, it's a risk in friendships to say this is who I'm going to be. And to a large extent, we're not particularly good at being courageous in that thing. But I think that ability to be your authentic self is a fundamentally courageous action.
Do you think people, when they're making a decision or making a choice on which way to go, do you think they're taking the easy way if they're not being courageous?
It would be presumptuous and, you know, arrogant of me to think that people always act out of courage. So I think we're lucky if in an organization people act out of courage 10% of the time. I mean, I think that most of the time we look at the situation, we assess the level of risk, and we say that risk with this particular leader isn't worth taking. And so I'm not going to be courageous here. And I've seen people that have taken that risk and been courageous, and I've seen it have really bad impacts on them. You know, let's not pretend that being courageous is easy. Let's realize that, you know, people have a level of self-preservation that they manage within their lives. And that sometimes that self-preservation means that in order to be successful in the organization, they're going to look at the times at which they take risks. Can I tell you that, you know, quite often as you go up through the levels of an organization, you are more able to be your authentic self because you have a level of empowerment, which is quite often hierarchical power, but that empowerment that allows you to reveal more of your authentic self. And at that level, it's seen as, it's quite often celebrated, the difference of our senior people. What's really sad is that level of authentic self isn't celebrated at the junior levels. People at the lower levels have to play the game. They have to be what's expected of them. And I think that's a real detriment to organizations, because I think that it means we're not actually uncovering or empowering or releasing the full potential of organizations, because we wait until they have a certain level of credibility or they reach a certain level in the hierarchy that they feel able to be who they are.
It's interesting. I'm going to go with, because you're saying the higher you get up, the more authentic you can be.
The more authentic you can be. I'm not sure that, I think to some extent, there's two things there. The more authentic you can be, but the more the risk. If you think about, you know, if you're a basic entry level person and you've come into an organization, the risk of you losing your job is, well, I'll get another job in another contact center. There, you know, turnover's at 35% at the moment. Whereas if I'm a general manager in an organization, I'm earning, you know, let's say $500,000 a year, there is a much higher level of risk in terms of what I would give up if what I'm saying, you know, actually doesn't accord with what my boss wants me to say. So you have, you know, it is always about, you know, risk and the assessment of risk and a decision to be courageous in the face of that risk and in the face of that fear. But certainly, I think that organisations, you know, we celebrate to some extent diversity at our senior levels that we don't celebrate at the lower levels. We, to some extent, we expect people to be a bit more, you know, we love it when our senior people, we say, oh, you know, they're involved in these things. But at the same time, I think it's within a narrow parameter of what acceptable is. And I think it's much higher level of risk for a senior person to come out and be courageous in the face of, say, an organizational shift that they don't agree with, you know, is much more courageous because what they are putting at risk is a much greater cost.
And what, the greater the risk, the greater the reward, right?
It's
an interesting way of looking at it.
But I think that, you know, behind this all is this understanding, and you said it before, Dave, which is that it's not the absence of fear. In fact, fear is the most natural feeling we have, whether we're faced with organizational change or we're faced with decisions that impact us, or we're put in a situation where we're asked to do something. Fear is essentially something that we all face. What becomes interesting then is the choices we make, what we do with that fear. Do we decide to, you know, if you like, probably the most common is inaction. So it's not destructive, it's not constructive, it's just passive. So if I'm going through an organizational change, if I put my head down, if I don't make waves, I hope that I will get through this, but I'm certainly not going to say anything. And I'm certainly not going to say anything that I disagree with because my boss who's making the decisions that might put me at risk. So the most natural thing is to do what most people do, which is stick your head in the sand and hope that it passes by. But you also have destructive people, the ones that, you know, want to kick up and scream, because destructiveness is also empowering. It may not be helpful, but it certainly gives people a sense of empowerment to rail against the things that they disagree with. But the most helpful is constructive, which is around understanding that there is a path I can navigate. I'm empowered to do this. And actually, the actions I have are going to have impacts on all the people that are around me as well, especially if I'm a leader. The way in which leaders deal with change and the way in which leaders deal with fear is culture changing, literally culture changing. If a leader in the face of fear can say, look, there's an opportunity for us to be victims here. Let's not choose that path. Let's actually say, what is it we can do? You know, where can we be empowered to make a substantial change? Or what can we do to actually feel as though these decisions are things that we're part of, not victims of?
In your experience, Stu, can you tell us the most courageous leader that you've ever had or that you've seen?
Ooh, the most courageous leader.
And what did they do?
I was working with one of the large banks and we were doing some work on culture. And the whole idea around culture was that culture change actually starts. Culture is a reflection of the fears of the leaders. You know, that's one of the big mantras. Culture of an organization is a reflection of the fears of the leaders. So if they fear disorganization or if they fear not knowing, then everything they do is trying to address that fear. And I remember working with a leadership team and we were doing some work on values and the person who was running it said, okay, what I want to do is I want to sit down with the leaders of this organization. So this was all, you know, executives in one of the big four banks. And we're going to talk about what legacy they want to leave. No matter how long they're in this organization, we're going to talk about the legacy that they leave. Because the insight was that for many people, getting to that level was their aspiration. And now that they were there, their behavior was to protect their being at that level, being at the C-suite, being at that table. And if that's what behavior, so if your behavior is to protect your position, almost everything you do is done out of fear. You know, you're so busy trying to protect your job that you don't understand what is your job. So we had this conversation about legacy and about what is it, if in 5 years' time, what is it you want people to say about the time here, your time here? Forget, you know, forget you in this situation. What is it you want people to say about the organization? And it wasn't until sort of I was working with the CEO that we actually started to have a conversation with her, and it was a female at the time, about this idea around fear. And we had probably a day-long session with this executive team about their own fears and some really interesting insights. The first one was that of the executive team, which was about 11 or 12 people, only one person was still in their first marriage. The second insight was that all of them had grown up in a household where there was a level of expectation on them. And I thought it was extremely courageous of not just the CEO, but this executive team to have a conversation about them as human beings, about their fears, about their aspirations, about this idea of legacy, this idea of what is it we want to leave behind. Because it's the first time ever in an organization that I've seen a group of people that senior have, you know, really, really intimate conversations about their unsuccessful relationships, about the cost of ambition, about the price they've paid to be successful, and about, to some extent, this idea that to, you know, you can't just be successful to achieve a position. You've got to have a purpose. You know? And so for me, you know, that was one of those really sort of awe-inspiring moments where I, you know, sort of had an epiphany around the role that purpose in our lives plays and the role that purpose in organization plays and what happens when there's a lack or a muddiness in that purpose and why organizations tend to meander. They tend to go through, you know, so much change just because you haven't got this executive team absolutely united around things like legacy, purpose, values. So I think that, you know, they're the sorts of courageous conversations that I think organizations need more of. I think they need them regularly. I think they need to be seen as an integral part of strategy, because at the moment what we have is organizations where the strategy sits over here, and then the other side we have, you know, the people and the fuzzy stuff, the human stuff. And I just think that that is a fundamental misread on how successful organizations work.
Guess what my next question is. What's the most courageous thing you've ever done, Stu?
I did this podcast in 2021. No. I think the most courageous thing I did was actually really quite early in my career. I was working for another one of the big four, and I went into a role where I was asked to assess about 80 branches with a view to closing 40 of them. And it was my role to not just work out which ones, but then to talk to the teams and to work with the managers and basically tell them that their branches were closing. And I quite early on decided that I wasn't going to do that. That was an awful thing. I hated the idea that organizations were going to do that. And I went through a real sort of what I would call a values clash, you know, my own values versus the values of the organization. And then I was talking to somebody and they said to me something like, well, if you don't do it, do you think the organization will still do it? And I said, yeah, of course they will. You know, it's not going to be, not going to be me, but it'll be someone else. And they said, well, so, what is it that you could do that's different to how you think someone else might do it? And I said, well, maybe I could do it in a way that actually looks at, empowering the people and actually talking to them about what's going on and the reasons why. And maybe we could spend a lot of time actually focusing on, as humans, how we're going to go through this change and give them a bit more power. And they said, well, maybe that's something you could do. And so I then did this for the next probably 2.5-3 years where I closed these branches. And I still have contact with some of the people that lost their jobs through that. But it was an opportunity to say, okay, well, the fear in me was that how was I going to feel being the guy that was responsible for them losing their jobs, which is an extraordinarily selfish fear when you consider that this was, 40 branches that we were closing. And when I reframed that, the courage was actually they're going to lose their jobs anyway. Own it. Think about what you could do that is different, that is constructive, that is helpful, and act in a way that is about helping them not be victims, helping them also be empowered to set their own course. And that was probably, I was probably about, I must have been between 25 and 30 when I did that. And it was probably one of the most, probably the most profound thing in terms of setting my course for being parts of organizations that constantly do things that I disagree with. But my role is not to agree or disagree. My role is to understand and help people transition through organizations, help people think about their own skills, help people think about what they can do to navigate a very impersonal process in a way that they don't come out of it feeling like a victim, that they come out of it feeling as though they've had some choices and they've made some courageous choices themselves. And I think that really sort of, is a really nice framing for what I would say is the role of courageous leaders, which is, if you can build courageous people, people who don't feel as though they're victims, people who feel empowered, I think then, that's a pretty awesome achievement.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's interesting. You've kind of touched on a few things there. You could have easily in that circumstance have taken a very passive role to it and avoidance and just, I'm going to do it this way.
But I wrote my resignation. I literally said, you can shove this. I'm not going to do that. I completely disagree with what you're doing. I completely disagree with the way you're doing it. And it's
inevitable. I've worked for big four banks from probably most of my career. I know that there's the inevitable truth of that. They always kind of look to downsize. But you thought you were going to be, rather than it's easy to be, and instead do be that passive or be the aggressive styles, you decided I'm going to make this negative into a more positive. We're going to be more constructive. Did you feel you had better? Did you try and empathize or show compassion? Is that how you kind of?
I'd say it's the other way around. I think it was the empathy that led to the courage. I don't think the courage led to the empathy. I think that when I was able to have someone shine a mirror in my face and say, you're the one with the job, mate, have a think about them, that empathy then sort of led on to, okay, well, you know, I can do more. I can, you know, I can actually step up and do something here. So the courage stemmed, the first step was empathy. Courage came from that. And I think that's a really interesting insight. I hadn't thought about that before, Dave, but this idea that we are nothing if we're not relational. You know, you can't, you know, you have to start at the relational level. You have to start with the understanding of the human experience, because if you can do that, then you are much more likely to see courage merely as a response to an empathy, merely as a response that is about me trying to help others in some way, shape, or form. I think the other way around is sort of like I act courageously. Oh, and by the way, some people get helped along the way. You know, I'm not sure we're smart enough to go that way.
Dave, what's the most courageous thing you've done?
I don't know. God, it's a thing. I've done a lot personal rather than business. Like the most courageous thing I did in my life was coming to Australia. So, and the story was, I was meant to go with my best friend. He decided to get back with his girlfriend, who's now his wife, and they have some lovely kids. So he obviously made a great decision there. So that left me on my own and to take the step to go on my own. And I think I just said it was the path. I felt it was the right choice for me in the path. So I tried to make, as I said, make contact with people I had a relationship with in college when I was doing it, and they were over there. So yeah, and then getting there, I just felt that coming to South Australia was the right thing to do for some reason, which is a strange thing. And I went there, and now I'm here. I've been in Australia about 21 years. Yeah, business time or professional. I don't know. I think I'm always a little bit of a disruptor, trying to stand up for people as much as I can. I try to take your point seriously. You've got the risk versus the reward. You know, some leaders are just not going to change. So you have to be a bit tactical if you want. It's like I can feel I've got this battle, I can win it. And that's probably more courageous to fight the battle. That's, you know, those historic war movies where the one guy is fighting the battle at the Alamo, they're never going to win. But I think it's better to, you know, pick your battles. And you can have a better impact than just sacrificing everything for one battle, which, you know, with a leader that potentially is never going to listen to you, you've gone to the well is dry, right? You've got nothing else to give, and you're no good to anyone after that.
Yeah, you've wasted that, what I would call courage capital. If you're going to rail against everything, you know, you're actually wasting your courage capital. But I think the other thing there is that just this judgment, you know, being able to judge when is being courageous going to actually have the impact that I want it to have, and when is being courageous just, you know, me wanting to stick my head up to shout, but I'm not sure it's going to be noticed. And I think that's experience and judgment. I've got a team that like to try different things and try new things, and I keep saying to them, that's great, but let's look at the timing. Let's look at what else is on here. Do you really think that someone's going to sign off on that new idea just because you think it's the best thing? And that's the sort of thing you're talking about, Dave. If every time there's an opportunity to be courageous, you decide we're going to push this idea now, when the right time comes up and you've been spending all of your capital pushing ideas every few weeks, then your boss just doesn't back you. So, you know, timing is everything.
So I'm going to try the question back to Renee.
I'm good.
So Renee, when was the most courageous time in your life or decision?
There have been a few, but I think maybe big and scary one was just over 12 months ago, where I resigned from my full-time permanent employment and went out on my own, started my own company, started my own Pilates studio, and it's all of a sudden I'm working for myself. So I think that's probably the most courageous thing I've done recently. I was just looking up this book that I'm reading at the moment, Stu, and there's a bit in here because we worked together recently. And as you and Dave were speaking before, so Dave and I are agile coaches, and I think every single day we are courageous to some extent when we're trying to change or suggest different ways of doing things, or trying to help teams, help people to become, be motivated about work. And this book has got some stuff in here around. So the book's called The Six Enablers of Business Agility by Karam Harbert. And in here, there's a, I don't even know, oh, this is the leadership and management chapter. The stages that a leader goes through when they start out as a leader, and then as they go through. So there's expert leadership, which are tactical problem solvers. They focus on making small incremental improvements to existing strategies within their unit, strong command and control micromanagers. And there's an achiever leadership who are strategic and outcome focused. They believe that power comes not only from expertise, but also from motivating others to contribute to larger objectives over a longer time frame. And then the last one is catalyst leadership. So catalysts are visionaries with a facilitative and culture focus. They believe that a leader's job is to nurture the organizational's culture and empower those around them and facilitate the development. They encourage openness, transparency, and participation. And when I read that part, I thought of you. And I was trying to, because I was working with you at the time, but I was thinking, you know, I don't think I know many catalyst leaders in that way. But I think from the stuff that you were doing with your team, not even your team, with anyone really who wanted to try things in different ways, the way that you supported them and empowered them, I thought was really, really cool.
Look, I think, yeah, your opinion's the only one that matters at the moment.
Thanks, Stu.
but here's the thing. I think organizations tend to value the other two more.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which means that they're far more tangible, they're far more measurable from a really empirical perspective. Measuring a catalyst is, you're looking at two things. One is that it's like ripples in an ocean. You know, you don't know where the source is, but if you started to try and measure the ripples, how would you go about that? And I think that, and it's over a longer period of time as well. So I think there's a level of, you know, what I would call a cause and effect that isn't quite there for many people for the catalyst. And also sometimes it's 2 years later that you start to see these ideas coming. So I had this idea, funnily enough, about 2 years ago, and I was looking at what was happening in the world. And at the time, there'd been some things around just the lack of jobs for people who were over 50. And that the demographics says that, you know, my kids are probably going to live, they've got a better than one in two chance of living to 100, which means that they're going to, in order to afford some retirement, they have to work until they're at least 80. How do you construct a way of working in which people tend to dip in and out of work, education, you know, learning, maybe travel, things like that? But you start to, you know, deconstruct this idea of education, employment, retirement, and reconstruct it as first education, first employment, travel, break, second education, second employment. You've got to actually think of work differently. So I was starting to look at, you know, ways in which we could tap into that by having a workforce to look at events, you know, and they might just want to work 3 months a year, and they might just want to come and work, and they might actually want to work in their community. So imagine if there is a large hailstorm, and actually 4 or 5 people in that community are people who are part of this broader, you know, network of an organization. Anyway, I started talking to a few people about that, and all of a sudden this idea has generated into something that someone who is more able than me actually knows how to implement. But it's that concept of, you know, where and who in organizations are having those conversations that catalyze ideas that can then be hothoused and can then sort of move forward through to execution. And I think that increasingly organizations find it difficult to hold those people as the organization. But I think organizations like people who can be empirically measured. They like people who, they do still like the command and control. They're the people that are seen as being, you know, the executioners, the, you know, the ones that get stuff done. But my concern is always getting stuff done is great as long as you're doing the right stuff. And who's making the decisions around what is the right stuff for today? And more importantly, who's making the decisions is what is the right stuff for tomorrow? And I think that's, yeah, I don't know organization. I don't, some of the startups do that well, but that's because that's what their gig is, their passion plays, they're innovators, they're entrepreneurial. And I think that, yep, and try and find those sort of innovative entrepreneurial people within large legacy businesses, and they pretty quickly get pushed out because there's just not the right environment to support them.
They're unicorns. It's like that. Same with those
characters. Exactly right, they are.
Because I think now, to give credit where credit's due, leadership agility, the idea is that Karim Kat is from Bill Joyner and Stephen Joseph's book called Leadership Agility. And yep, they said a catalyst to, like, it's 2 or 3% of the leaders. It would be good to increase that a little bit. I would say that, now I'm trying to remember, but the the lower end or whatever the other, there's five levels of mastery in it or something like that. But at the bottom level, there'd be probably the one or two levels, there'd be a lot of them at the moment, based on the kind of systems and structures that exist in large organizations.
But part of the issue there is that if you think about why people get promoted to higher levels of leadership, we end up with our top level of leaders who should be the catalysts, who should be the strategists. But in order to get there, what they've had to do is be really successful engineers or really successful executors or really successful. So we actually don't even promote the people to the level, you know, we don't have the people at the top level who should be running organizations. We have the people at the top level who have been really successful at doing lower level management. In fact, so successful that they've been promoted to that through those ranks, which is an inherently flawed process for organizations in terms of why they have, and to some extent, it's why we have fairly limited cultural diversity at the top of organizations, because what we've done is we've promoted people through who do the things that we've always done well. It's why we don't have ethnic diversity. It's why we don't have gender diversity. We certainly don't have what I would call intellectual diversity, thought diversity, which at the end of the day is what I think should be valued most highly at the executive level and the board level. But my experience is that it's not. In fact, one of the saddest things I heard was one of the executive team at an organization that I was working with saying, "It's fantastic. We all think the same." And I was thinking, that's probably the most dangerous thing that you could say about an executive team.
Yep, that is very sad. Also probably very common.
Yeah, absolutely. Really common.
Too common.
So as a courageous leader, what are some, do you have any hints or tips that you could pass on to other leaders who are listening to this podcast and are questioning whether they're courageous themselves or how they can make that decision next time they come up against something?
Because can I say, courage is a muscle. It's a muscle. It's not an innate courageous people and non-courageous people. But I think the first is to normalize the experience of fear. Fear is something that the most courageous people also feel fear. And so, you know, step one is accept that fear is a natural part of being in part of an organization, especially organizations in this day and age that are constantly going through change. So you are going to feel fear. The second is to, you know, call it mindfulness, call it awareness, but to understand and reflect on and be aware of your own feelings of fear. Because if you're not aware of them, there's no ability to choose to act differently. You'll just react. You can't act intentionally when you're not aware of what you're feeling. So step two is, you know, understand when you are feeling fear. Step three is to stop, not just react, but to put a pause in there that allows you to act intentionally. And as we've spoken about previously, it may not always be the case that you feel, you know, courageous enough to act in courage every single time, but you will never get to the point where you can make those choices if you don't stop and actually think about your range of choices that you can make. The fourth one is probably what I would call challenge your negative perspective. Test some things. Do something do something courageous and see if it works. What we all do is we all overlay an expectation that if I act courageously, everything will go to crap and, you know, I'll lose my job, yada, yada, yada. But these are just, you know, this is part and parcel of the human experience where we're not designed to take unnecessary risks. So what we do is we have this internal dialogue that tells us this isn't going to work. They won't like this, but find a place to test that. So test those assumptions that you're making about how your behavior will play out and then reflect on what happened as a result of that. And then do it again. And if you can go through that process and sort of each time you feel fear, think about what are my choices? I'm going to try this. And I'm going to look for feedback and I'm going to adjust in response to that feedback. And as we've said, don't think that you need to go from never speaking courageously to speaking courageously every time anyone says anything, you know, baby steps. And listen to the universe. I mean, you said it before. Listen to the universe about what feedback you're getting. How do you feel about that? How did you feel when you were courageous? Did you feel, actually, I feel really good about myself because that worked, and that would be my back of a coaster, five-step, be more courageous. I could turn it into a book if you like.
Nice. I love it.
What song do you listen to build up your courage?
I have a very, very eclectic musical taste, but last week was my daughter's last HSC exam and I woke her to AC/DC's Thunderstruck. Very loud, on every speaker, every speaker in the house. And it certainly gets the blood pumping. So you know, things like that are really sort of, I love picking music that sort of is appropriate for whatever mood I want to get in.
Yeah.
But that was a good example. ACDC's a good one to do that.
Renee, what's your go-to Courage song?
Pink has a song that's actually called Courage. And there's a couple of her song that when I listen to it, it sort of gets me going. And maybe that's partly because she's female and so, you know, courageous herself in some of the things that she does and says. So some of the lyrics, have I the courage to change and don't have to do this perfectly?
Mm, that's good. Dave?
I'd have to say, I'm going to have to go with two. I couldn't really choose between them. So one is Queen, The Show Must Go On. You know, it has to keep them going on no matter what. You've got to keep on moving forward. And the other one is, it's kind of been, I've been watching The Beatles, that, what's his name?
Yeah, on Disney Channel.
Kind of name of season now, but Let It Be. It's always just, you know, having the courage to let things be and go on your own path.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, let's do Fast Five. So the first one, what book are you reading at the moment, Stu?
I've always got a number of books on the go at the same time. I'm reading a novel called One Day at the moment, which is just it's a one day in the lives of two people every year for 20 years. And so it actually explores their relationship every year for 20 years. It's actually a really cool book. I'm also reading another Malcolm Gladwell book. So if you haven't read any of Malcolm Gladwell's books or listened to his podcast, Revisionist History, but I'm rereading Blink, which is a book about the way in which we respond to and understand things and make quick judgments and quick decisions, and both the power of that and the inherent danger in doing that. I think that's probably the two that I'm reading at the moment.
What's your favourite smell?
Oh, I don't know how to describe it. When I was young, we lived in Darwin and we'd moved there before we had anywhere to stay. So we were staying in a little motel, and this was like, we're staying in a motel and I'm one of four kids. So it was mum and dad and the four of us, six of us in a motel room that was, imagine just in a motel room with, you know, a double bed and maybe one single. And we had to get all our meals. So we went out to a restaurant that was just down the road. It was called The Capri. And I was 5 years old, and it had a smell that even to this day, if I smell it, it just evokes such strong memories of my childhood. And sort of as a complete aside, every night that we went there, I ordered chips and eggs. I was only five, but chips and eggs. And I got crinkle cut chips and a soft fried egg, and I dipped my chips into the egg.
That best.
Chips and eggs. It's, look, you know, it's almost Irish, isn't it, really, Dave?
Chips and Irish cuisine, it's up there.
No, there wasn't enough potato.
Yeah, there's only one kind of potato one. You should have had at least two. As a kid, what was your favourite toy?
It had to be my bike, my bicycle. It was obviously a chance just to get out of the house and to ride. And we lived in Canberra for a while and there was all these hills around and we'd just ride paths, just me and probably a couple of friends. But bike was a sense of, it was the closest I got to international travel as a kid. You'd go anywhere. You'd leave as soon as the sun came up, and as long as you were home before the streetlights were on, that was a good day. Yeah, favorite toy.
And now, what TV show are you currently binging?
I've just finished that Beatles one. I don't know if we watched Only Murders in the Building, which was really good fun. And the other one, I'm towards the end of the second season of Ted Lasso. So if you haven't watched Ted Lasso, then very, very funny, but with a real sense of heart, a real sense of pathos. It's lovely. Yes.
Feel good. Just a feel good TV show, isn't it?
Yep.
Final question. The end of the world is coming. What's the last thing you do?
I think that it would be almost as a reflection on you know, this conversation of courage. It would be to gather my family together and to say, look, you know, we don't know what the future holds, but I'm not going to sit here and just be a victim. Let's do something together. But it'll be with my family. I think that's, it doesn't really matter where, when, or how, but that's what I'd do.
Thank you for your time, Stu.
It's a pleasure.